Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Akiva Tor is the Consul General of Israel for the Pacific Northwest. He has served as World Jewish Affairs Advisor to the President of Israel, Director of the Israeli Economic and Cultural Office in Taipei, and Deputy Director for Palestinian Affairs in the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Akiva is a graduate of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and holds an MA degree from Hebrew University in Jewish Political Thought and a BA from Columbia University in General Philosophy. He served as a paratrooper in the Israel Defense Forces and as an infantry captain in the IDF Reserves. Please join me in welcoming Akiva Tor to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much, John, and welcome, audience. I would like to describe the strategic environment in the Middle East from the way it appears to Israel looking out on our region. We see a region going through a prolonged political earthquake, nearing soon 2 years, where almost every regime and every society in the region is going through some sort of fundamental change or transformation, where the outcome is as yet unclear. But a number of aspects of how the political terrain will look in the Middle East are clear, even when this earthquake will cease its tremoring. And that is primarily the rise of political Islam in the region. We see it really pretty much everywhere from the Atlantic coast to the Indian Ocean. In Morocco, the parliamentary elections delivered a victory for parties of political Islam. In Tunisia, considered by many to be the most cosmopolitan Arab state in North Africa, the parliamentary elections delivered a similar outcome. In Libya, it is unclear yet what will be the political configuration at the top. Likewise in Syria, although if the Assad regime is defeated, as may well happen, it seems a likelihood or certainly a possibility that the Sunni political opposition will coalesce around the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, and we will see a victory of political Islam there as well. But primarily, first and foremost, and most importantly, as always in the Arab world, Egypt. Here, the parliamentary elections, after three rounds, which were free and fair, delivered a clear victory for political Islam against, it should be mentioned, the predictions of almost all Western pundits and research institutes. The Muslim Brotherhood received approximately 46% of the vote. The Salafist Party, approximately 25%. In other words, more than three-quarters of the Egyptian parliament is represented by parties of political Islam, with the liberal and secular parties being represented by no more than 15%. So the first thing, I think before one would attempt to make a value judgment on this, whether, and we can debate whether one should even make a value judgment about it, but first and foremost, this is a political fact. And we may not know exactly who will be the next Egyptian president that will be elected in June, or exactly the place of the military in the continuing political life of Egypt, but political Islam won the elections. And this is a political ideology which represents the free choice of the majority of Egyptians, and probably, very likely, the majority of Arab voters in every place in which free elections are held or perhaps will be held. Now, what does it mean for Israel? For Israel, it's quite a question. We have not yet had a relationship with a government dominated by political Islam. With the government of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, we had a relationship which was with an Egypt defined formally as a secular nationalist Arab state. And in many ways, secular Arab nationalism perhaps leaves place for an accommodation with the national movement of the Jewish people, Zionism, which perhaps there is less place for that in the viewpoint of political Islam, which might see history in the Middle East, in the lands of the Middle East, through the lens of a more religio-historical rather than a secular historical kind of outlook. So when we are looking at that, we are wondering, and I must say, we are curious how things will be. Let me start with talking about the nature of our relationship of Israel's relationship with Egypt, with Egyptian society. Well, I have to say that it's primarily a relationship which has been difficult to forge. We've had peace with the Egyptian government for more than 30 years, a peace that has been well respected and deeply pursued by both governments. But I cannot say that the Egyptian government under Mubarak was interested in normalization or a relationship between the societies. We did not see, it did go in a certain direction. There is much Egyptian culture on display in the cities of Israel and in our cinematheques and on our television. The Egyptian ambassador is welcome at every party in Herzliya. In fact, it would be difficult to have a correct one or a good one without the Egyptian diplomatic presence. The Egyptian diplomatic representative in Israel has access to all quarters of government, Knesset, every party, television, radio, access directly to the Israeli people. If they so wish and desire to speak directly and not necessarily through our government. At the field of film, Egyptian movies have been on Israel TV for decades, and Israeli artists and their creations are welcome at all of our film festivals. The problem, however, is in the opposite direction, because when the Egyptian filmmaker comes to Tel Aviv or to Jerusalem or to Haifa to show their film, they may find themselves being ejected from the filmmakers' union by the artistic class in Egypt or by the artists' union. We do not have access to the Egyptian economy. There is not much connection between the Israeli economy and the Egyptian economy, except for that small zone which, by treaty with the United States, enables export to the United States through at beneficial terms because of a cooperation between Israel and Egypt. But by and large, successive Egyptian governments have not encouraged that relationship. The Israeli ambassador in Egypt does not have access to the editorial offices of any Egyptian newspaper, is not welcome to appear on Egyptian radio or television, and cannot safely and will not be invited to any Egyptian university campus or classroom. So we don't have a relationship with the society, and we're sad about it, but this is the way it has been, and perhaps the way it will continue to be. With the military, we've had quite a good relationship and a lot of security cooperation in the past in the Sinai and in carrying out all of the requirements of the Camp David Agreement. But of course, what will be with that as we move forward will depend on the place of the military within the Egyptian political system. So we are wondering what things will be like with the new Egyptian government. And there are pluses, or there are reasons for optimism, and there are reasons for perhaps some pessimism. But I would much prefer to focus on the optimistic. I can say we, for our part, welcome the new Egyptian government, which is emerging, and we will welcome any elected president of Egypt, and we will seek to engage them in as deep a relationship for the mutual benefit of our states as is possible. If things go really well, or if things go reasonably well, this will be the first case where Israel has a working political peace and relationship with an Arab government of political Islam. and perhaps that will open doors in other places in the region. Right now, we do have some emerging challenges there, primarily in Sinai. The security situation in Sinai has deteriorated. We don't think that this is because the Egyptian military wants it to deteriorate, but there has been a loss of control, and our southern border has become less safe, and pretty much everything that can go into Gaza and pretty much anything can be transported through a tunnel. Both Mercedes-Benz's refrigerators and TNT is going into Gaza right now. The gas pipeline between Egypt and Israel was bombed more than 10 times. In any case, the business agreement between the Egyptian gas company and the Israeli gas company has come to an end. But there is a problem of security in Sinai that's an immediate outcome, which we hope will be temporary. Our other neighbor, Jordan, with whom we have a peace treaty, remains stable throughout the political earthquaking. We are gratified to see it. We view the Kingdom of Jordan as a fine and excellent neighbor, as a country ruled by a decent and modest monarchy which cares for their people. And we believe that it's an abiding national security interest of the State of Israel that Jordan continue to succeed. And we very much hope that this will be the case, and all indications seem to indicate that. Regarding our relations with the Palestinians, here the situation, I would say, is really very quite complicated, quite interesting, and quite requiring analysis. Because I would say from the Israeli perspective, everything which is going on in our region, in Syria, in Egypt, in North Africa, in the Emirates, is out of our control. We have to look at it, analyze it, understand it to the best of our capacity, and prepare for any and all eventualities, but we cannot control it. But with the Palestinians, we do have a relationship, and we do have a political process. Let me speak, let me devote some words to this situation. The Egyptian revolution has affected Palestinian politics. And one way in which it's clearly affected Palestinian politics is the greater strength and political popularity to a certain extent of Hamas. The reason being that Hamas is a movement which is politically aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas could be described as the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. But whereas the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has accepted the peace treaty as a sovereign obligation of the Egyptian state and has voiced no intention of abrogating the peace treaty with Israel, Hamas does not recognize Israel, does not recognize any of the agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and does not recognize our legitimacy in the region at all. But the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood as a majority power in Egypt has affected Palestinian politics and has made Hamas perhaps more popular than it was in the past. Between the Palestinian Authority and the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza, there is a continued dance which has been going on for some years and talks about the possibility of the establishment of a Palestinian national unity government. Now, we understand the desire of a stateless people to want to be ruled by one unified leadership principle. At the same time, we from Israel's perspective also have to live with the outcome. And I have to say that it would be a very, very deep challenge for us if Hamas and the Palestinian Authority ultimately do unite and Hamas ministers enter into a Palestinian Authority government. I think it'll make it very difficult for us to move forward towards a peace agreement when we will be signing with a government where many of the ministers do not even recognize our legality or our moral presence in any way. So this is a challenge. But in the meantime, it has not happened. The Palestinians were talking until a few months ago about holding elections throughout the West Bank and Gaza in June, but we've not seen any indications that they are indeed preparing for these elections. There are elections which have been pushed off many times. So far, it does not happen. The West Bank, on the other hand, is still succeeding economically with high levels of growth. We very much respect our interlocutors on the Palestinian side, President Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, who have both really done incredible work to decrease corruption in the throughout the Palestinian Authority, to encourage growth, to encourage employment, to have encouraged security. And we hear that Ramallah and Nablus are cities which are doing well, and we are very happy about this. The success of the Palestinian economy is an abiding Israeli national interest as well. So the question is, what will happen? And here I fear that we may find ourselves in a situation where the opportunities for concluding a permanent peace of treaty between Israel and the Palestinian Authority have receded. I say this as from an analytical perspective. Of course, it's conceivable that our political leadership and the Palestinian political leadership can come together and indeed reach an agreement very, very quickly. And halavai, we would say in Hebrew, would that that would happen. On the one hand, the political picture of how an agreement between us should look is clear, and we actually agree on it. Both Israel and the Palestinian Authority agree that the correct way to achieve peace between us is through the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, living in a formal agreement of peace and friendship, and as much cooperation as both sides can tolerate with each other, which hopefully would be much. So if we agree on these key elements, why do I feel that perhaps the chances of reaching an agreement at this moment have receded a little bit? One, I do believe that one of the outcomes of the Arab awakening and the strengthening of political Islam and everything which is happening in Egypt has weakened the Palestinian moderate leadership and its capacity to reach an agreement with us. Egypt under Mubarak was always the solid and most important Arab political support for the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. And that leadership is not there anymore. The Egyptians are involved with their own things, and it's also unclear to what extent the Muslim Brotherhood a government which dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists will be supportive of such a peace treaty between us. But in any case, the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, finds itself with less political support for moving towards us to an agreement. Because in order to sign such a peace treaty, we have to agree on end of claims, end of state of war. In our view, the Palestinians have to acknowledge that Palestinian refugees will be resettled in a Palestinian state and not within Israel. We have to reach an agreement on Jerusalem, which will surely be difficult for both sides. I don't think that the Palestinian governance at this moment is able to take decisions like that, given the political situation in the region. From our perspective, I think any Israeli government looking at the political scene also has to ask itself, how will the Middle East look in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 2 years from now? I'm not certain that any Israeli government at this time would be willing to repeat offers that were made in the last decade, which were very, very far-reaching in terms of territorial concessions, given the current situation of uncertainty in the Middle East, and the lack of clarity who will rule the Palestinians in a year or two from now. Finally, I'd like to speak a little bit about Iran, and then to open this forum for questions, discussion. Well, I have to say that it's gratifying, and all citizens of the world, I think, should be gratified that we finally have a fairly stringent set of sanctions in place. I arrived here in the Bay Area 4 years ago, and nothing like it was in place. There was when I met members of Congress in the region, there was much skepticism whether it would be possible for the international community to put stringent economic sanctions on Iran until they desist from their nuclear weapons program. But they are in place, and it is affecting the Iranian currency and the Iranian economy, the Iranians' capacity to carry out international banking, and that is all good. What I think is not good is that it's probably not enough to really deter the regime from its aim of achieving a nuclear weapon. It probably has been enough to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. Those negotiations with the P plus one, which are the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, have renewed. They met once. The next round of negotiations will be in Baghdad on May 23rd. I have to say that we Israelis are skeptical. We believe that the Iranian government and the ruling class in Iran is committed and devoted to the achievement of nuclear weapons, and that they will try to use these negotiations as a way to string things out. But we will wait and see. What we do believe is that if these negotiations do not succeed, it's important for the Western negotiating partners to understand quickly if there is a possibility of reaching a satisfactory agreement, and if not, to move on to a much deeper level of economic sanctions. A much deeper level of economic sanctions would be something which would prevent Iran from exporting oil and natural gas and from importing refined petroleum. 70% of the Iranian economy is directly dependent on those activities. And while we have no desire to cause hardship, nor I think does anyone in the West have any desire to cause hardship to the Iranian population, we may be in a situation where the Iranian government will not desist in its aim unless it feels that its rule is, the stability of its rule is threatened. That can probably only happen through a much, much deeper sanctions regime. We also believe that in order for a sanctions regime to be effective, there has to be a credible threat of use of force. In other words, Iran does need to know that at the end of the day, in addition to the economic hardship, at the end of the day, their nuclear facilities will not continue. And they will not be allowed to enrich uranium to weapons grade, or to develop a warhead, or to fit it on their intermediate ballistic missiles, because steps will be taken. If we are clear on that, there will be a much greater chance for economic sanctions to take the desired effect and to achieve it without any need for military force. An Iranian nuclear weapon would threaten all of us. Perhaps it would threaten us in Israel first, but everyone else is standing right behind us. It would empower the Shiite revolutionary ideology. It would threaten the entire region and cause a nuclear arms race. It would enable Iran to project its power and its ideology, which is quite violent, with ever more force. It would be a danger to world peace. And we in Israel very, very much appreciate the understanding of the international community, the coming together around this. And we hope that it will be possible to keep this leadership united and strong and getting to the desired place in order to keep Iran from achieving that end. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Israeli Consul General Akiva Tor for his opening remarks. Akiva, if you want to take a seat, and we'll go to questions. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm going to be moderating today's question and answer period. And Akiva, your talk has spurred a number of really good questions from the audience. We had a couple questions from audience members who wanted to wanted you to elaborate on the point of why the Egyptian revolution has emboldened and actually helped Hamas's popularity. What's your analysis of why that happened?
Well, success engenders success. And the fact that the political Islam and those parties won the elections in Egypt. One second. The fact that they won the elections in Egypt has effect on other societies as well. And this is our understanding of it. Thanks very much. This is our understanding of the situation, because prior to the elections in Egypt, Hamas was not interested at all in holding elections in the Palestinian Authority throughout the Palestinian territories, probably because they believed that they would lose. Now they may believe that they have a possibility of succeeding. And that can only be understood as relating to what has happened in Egypt. Because if one looks at the territory itself, the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority has been arguably wildly successful, both in terms of economic growth over 7%, lower unemployment, greater safety, higher standards of living, compared to Hamas rule in Gaza, which is quite an unhappy story.
Another question on the situation in Egypt and how it relates to the Palestinian situation. If the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt recognizes Israel, why does its rise to power necessarily embolden Hamas to continue to deny Israel's right to exist? It seems it might moderate the Hamas position.
I think that this is an excellent point, and hopefully true. Our position, Israel's position vis-à-vis Hamas, is not ideological. Our position vis-à-vis Hamas is not similar to what our position was vis-à-vis the PLO in the 1970s, where we rejected the PLO as a negotiating partner for peace because we believed that they were ideologically committed to our destruction, and we were not willing to speak to them pretty much no matter what they would say. That is not our view vis-à-vis Hamas. We have our position is that if Hamas will accept the quartet conditions, namely recognition of the State of Israel, renunciation of terror, acceptance of the legality and bindingness of the Israeli-Palestinian agreements from the Oslo Accord through the interim agreement agreed up till now, because that's the framework of all of our relations, and we will accept them as a legitimate partner for peace.
Akiva, you said the elections in the different Arab countries were fair. What do you think the people were hoping for by voting for an Islamist government? And what is in it for them, and what do you see in the future for women in these countries?
Well, I commented more about the Egyptian elections, which I know better than the others. Here I think it's not my job to comment. I think the societies are traditional. The societies are religious, the societies are conservative, and therefore they are attracted to these parties. And I'm not going to make any judgment one way or another, whether these ideologies are appropriate choices or not. That is the decision, the sovereign decision of the people. I think that there is a challenge for the equality of women.
In terms of the moderation of Hamas and getting it to acknowledge Israel's right to existence, et cetera, what role do you think either Israel or the United States can play in trying to get Hamas to that position? Or do you think, which clearly our two countries have been pushing for, or is Hamas basically a hopeless cause?
I think that the ability of the United States or Israel to affect Hamas is not high, but the Egyptians can. And the Palestinians within themselves can perhaps as well. So I don't want to create a false sense of optimism, because I'm not hugely optimistic that Hamas will change its positions in a fundamental way. But I do not say that it's impossible. But if it will happen, it will happen because of an internal Palestinian or an internal Arab dynamic. Our capacities for affecting them one way or another are not great. Their views are ideological. And therefore, the decisions and are based on religion, doctrine, and therefore, I do not think they are not necessarily strategic considerations. There's often a tendency to equate the power politics with Hamas or with Iran to those of the United States and the Soviet Union during the period of superpower competition. And I don't think that this is, strictly speaking, correct. The parties are rational, but their goals may not seem rational to us in the same way. In other words, if you have a religious ideal behind your strategic conception, it may be harder for us to understand exactly their rational calculation or the rationality of their calculation.
I'd like to remind our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and then you are listening to The New Middle East in Israel with Consul General Akiva Tor. I'm John Diaz of the San Francisco Chronicle, and we have plenty more audience questions about Iran. Starting with, could the Consul General explain why containment of Iran's nuclear program is a non-starter for Israel?
Well, we simply think that it would change the strategic situation in the region in a very grave way. The Egyptians and the Saudis are not going to accept the presence of an Iranian nuclear weapon unless they have one as well in order to deter it. That they will consider that an essential part of their containment policy. So we will see immediate crash nuclear programs throughout the Middle East. But again, there is no reason for the Iranians to get there. It can be prevented. It should be prevented. I sometimes wonder, I mean, when this argument about containment is made, is this the way people spoke before the Soviet Union achieved nuclear weaponry? Well, let them achieve it, and then we will contain them. Look at the huge cost to the West and to freedom of hundreds of millions of people due to Soviet weaponry for decades. Why get to a situation where one has to contain? It should be prevented.
Although you were expressed some satisfaction that there are real economic sanctions on Iran right now, you were somewhat dubious that it would actually have the effect of changing their desire and intent to develop a nuclear weapon. You talked about if that fails, as you're suggesting you think it probably will, of having a much deeper level of economic sanctions, basically cutting off Iran's oil business. Tell me what that would look like. In some ways, that sounds a bit like war. It would certainly require some military effort, would it not?
Well, I think that we have to. War is war, and sanctions are sanctions. And until sides are shooting at each other, it's not war, it's sanctions. In order to achieve that level of sanctions, it will require cooperation of Russia and China and other countries that are in Asia primarily, to a certain extent in Europe, which are currently importing Iranian oil. A way to stop it is not to buy it. That's one very, very good way to prevent the export of Iranian oil and natural gas, simply for it not to be purchased.
Do you think it would take some level of physical intervention as well, such as a blockade?
I think this is not for Israel to dictate. It's for the international community to figure out how to achieve its decision. That could be a possibility. Or there could be very, very strong economic cooperation, which will enable the prevention of the export of these goods from Iran.
Another audience question. How long do you think Israel reasonably can wait to temporize before it takes measures to halt Iran's development of a nuclear weapon?
Well, this is something which is much discussed in the Israeli press, but little discussed by Israeli officials. And I will pass on this question.
I wasn't expecting an answer necessarily, but as the advocate for the audience up here, I thought I would try. Here's another audience question. Israel seemingly persists in goading the United States into bombing Iran. What do you surmise about that? And first of all, I guess the part one would be, do you agree with the premise?
Not in any way. I mean, we have an extremely good strategic dialogue and strategic understanding with the United States regarding Iran. We may not agree on every tactical step and on every tactical move, but we do agree on the broad strategic vision, which President Obama has said clearly that an Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable. So I don't see us goading the United States anywhere. I see us cooperating, and when we disagree about how things look, discussing it at every level, both at the level of our intelligence agencies and at the executive level as well.
Turning to another subject, a perennial interest in the Middle East, water. Audience member asks, water is a key issue for all in the Middle East. Is there any work being planned jointly with the Arab countries on this subject? After all, this is a survival issue for all in the region.
So we have water agreements with Jordan in the framework of the Israel-Jordanian Peace Treaty, in which we share the waters which come down from the Golan Heights and from the Yarmouk River Basin. And we both sides scrupulously abide by the agreement because there's not enough water and we need it, and we just do what the agreement says. We also have a water agreement with the Palestinians. And that was part of the interim agreement signed back in 1995, which talked about, first of all, recognized the fact that both Israel and the Palestinians, we share the same geography and the same aquifers as the ideology song that we don't share. But we do share a southern mountain aquifer and a northern mountain aquifer and the Gaza water aquifer. All of us are dependent on the same underground water. And therefore, one of the things that came up quickly when we began to work was, okay, where can water be drilled? Who can drill what? How much water can be pumped? How do we treat sewage? The problem is that the interim agreement is not being well enough put into effect by on the Palestinian side. But it's certain that we will have to cooperate on this. At the end of the day, though, there's not enough water in the region. We know from the Bible, as well as from current atmospheric science, that we have several years of drought every 7 years. But the truth is that even if we will have rainy winters every year, we still will not have water enough between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Ocean for the peoples who are there. Therefore, that means that we have to find another way to create water resources. The only way to do that, so far that we understand, is desalinization of waters in the Mediterranean Ocean. That's something that we are doing quite aggressively. Right now, 25% of Israel's drinking water is desalinated. Almost all of our agricultural irrigation is gray water, or water which used to be sewage and now is partially treated and or treated enough in order to use it in agriculture. And we've basically stopped growing crops which require lots of water. We don't grow cotton anymore, and we grow less citrus than in the past. Our goal, however, is to move up to 50% desalination or as a source of water. And I think it is clear that if and when we will achieve a peace treaty with the Palestinian people, we will also have a very deep water agreement. And I have no doubt that there will be Palestinian desalination plants on Israeli territory with access to the Mediterranean. Perhaps we will run them jointly, perhaps not. That's for the sides to agree. But that will be the direction.
Why did Turkey turn against Israel, and how serious do you think the rift is?
I don't want to say anything which will increase the rift. And especially since we're talking for broadcast, I'll be... We would like to have an excellent relationship with Turkey. We did. I think that the current Turkish leadership has a different view of the region. I don't think that Israel is the only country which is feeling the difference in the Turkish orientation. But there's no reason for it. And we look forward to the moment when our relations will become warmer and return to normal.
What is your assessment of the elections over the weekend in France in terms of what that means for that country's relationship with Israel?
I'm certain that the diplomatic answer is that it won't mean anything because we have wonderful relations both with the socialists as well as with the party of Mr. Sarkozy. But I think that we'll have to wait and see. I very much hope that that France will maintain its leadership and current stance, or the stance that it had until yesterday regarding Iran, which was very, very strong. France was a leader of sanctions in Europe, helped lead the European Union to quite stringent sanctions and to agreements which were in many ways further ahead than the United States at some levels. And I hope France will continue in that direction.
Let's turn to elections in Israel. How will early elections in Israel affect the peace process?
That's a very good question. And I think the answer is known only to God. Because, first of all, who will win the elections and how will the next coalition look? It's unclear. To the best of my knowledge, the Israeli Knesset has not yet formally decided to dissolve itself, although that seems to be the indication that that's the direction we're going. Israel is a parliamentary system, not a presidential system, and therefore parliament can choose to dissolve itself by majority vote. Normally, Netanyahu, the current government's term of office would have gone into late 2013, so we would be more than a year away from elections right now. But Prime Minister Netanyahu has spoken about the possibility of holding elections in September. There are all kinds of explanations why. I don't think it's my job in this forum to be an analyst of Israeli internal politics. It wouldn't be wise or smart. So I'll just tell you that there's quite a good article in the New York Times today about it.
You sound like a man who's going to be heading back to Israel soon. Making sure you don't leave anything here online or on the internet that might create some issues. Speaking of elections, in a test of your diplomacy, we have an election here in the United States this year. What is your critique of the differences between both the President Obama and his presumptive challenger Mitt Romney in terms of their positions on the Mideast?
Well, both President Obama has been a great friend of Israel, and Mitt Romney is also a great friend of Israel. And so the essential U.S.-Israel relationship will continue however the United States decides. There's a problem with elections, of course, are always a problem, both in our country and in your country, is that they're a huge, they're hugely entertaining generally, but also a distraction from very, very important things that are happening in the world. And I very much hope that your elections will not distract primarily from the Iranian issue, which is burning and is really at approaching a moment of decision.
Reminder to our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and that you are listening to the new Middle East and Israel with Consul General Akiva Tor. Let's go back to the Palestinian situation. What do you say to those who say that the settlements are the reason the Palestinians won't negotiate with Israel?
I think it can't be justified by facts on the ground. Israel has not established new settlements in over a decade. We've allowed the growth of existing settlements within their designated boundaries, but we have not expropriated Palestinian land. And we have not expanded our presence in a massive way in the West Bank other than to allow population to grow naturally. And I don't think that anything that has happened there in the last decade has changed the capacities for reaching an agreement between the two sides. And I think Israel proved it. Israel proved it during the Gaza disengagement. In the Gaza disengagement in the summer of 2005, Israel removed 9,000 Israeli citizens who were living in Gaza and 21 settlements in the space of 5 days. So it used to be said before the Gaza disengagement that Israel could never remove a settlement. And well, it's just not factually true. The other thing is that the majority of the settlers and the majority of the settler population is not far from the 1967 border. And if and when we will reach an agreement, we probably can find a way to work it out in a way which Palestinians may receive some of our land. We may receive part of their land, but the principle being that the maximum amount of Israelis will be under Israeli sovereignty, the maximum number of Palestinians will be under Palestinian sovereignty, can enable an agreement. So I just do not agree that this is what is preventing an agreement at all.
Another audience question. Considering that there are currently around 2,500 Palestinian prisoners on their 21st day of hunger strike, and another some prisoners on their 70th day of fast, and they've been protesting the administration's detention, imprisonment without charges, and other practices, doesn't this aspect of the occupation constitute a greater threat to peace than Hamas?
Well, one of the reasons that the hunger strikers are striking is because they want to resume their university studies. I don't think that we're required in all circumstances to enable people who have carried out terror actions to pursue a university degree while they're in our prisons. I think it is a challenge for Israel, and we have to figure out how to deal with this. In many cases, the cases of administrative detention are coming before the Israeli court, both military and in some cases the Supreme Court, to determine whether the evidence is sufficient to continue to hold the people. But there's no question that the hunger strike is a challenge for us, and it's happened in the past, and we will deal with it the best we can.
How much support do you think Abbas has from Palestinians on the West Bank and in Gaza?
I don't know to answer that really exactly. Khalil Shikaki is a Palestinian pollster who does this kind of research all the time, and he has a website. Our sense is that the Fatah is the most popular party in the West Bank, but I cannot tell you what would be the result if Palestinian elections were held today exactly. Nor can I tell you exactly what would be the result of a Palestinian vote in Gaza. I can say my own sense, maybe I'm overly optimistic, I do not think that Hamas would achieve the votes that they would want. And I do not think that they would be able to win the elections, and I think that's one of the reasons why the elections are not happening. But that's my assessment, and it's not scientific, and it's also my fondest hope.
I'm interested in your reflections on your time here in San Francisco. You've been here 4 years, probably within the United States. There's certainly more pro-Palestinian sentiment in parts of this area than most parts of the country. What's your assessment overall on, first of all, domestic opinion here in the United States towards the Middle East? Do you see it evolving? Is it as strong as ever for Israel? What do you see the challenges?
So I would divide it into two things. I think that, broadly speaking, I feel really incredible friendship of the American people for Israel. And, you know, there's a great desire in the United States for peace in the Middle East and for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. But first and foremost, I feel a tremendous friendship. And I feel that people speak about the Bay Area being different. Honestly, I don't feel that way, because when I meet your elected officials, both here in the city of San Francisco, your senators, your members of Congress who are elected from this region, I find tremendous friendship at all times. And I do believe that by and large, in general, the elected officials of the United States are reflective of what their voters feel. And I feel it at all times. At the same time, there has been a change in the tone of debate and a greater polarization. And it bothers me a lot. I think it's reflective of the polarization that I detect in the general American political discourse, which, in my view, is not good for the American democracy. This is not a good model for democracies anywhere. It's an awful thing when the world looks at American political culture, which is really, I think, has been the gold standard for how a society can ideally rule itself in an enlightened way, and to see a debate which is so rancorous and sometimes not substantive, both on the right and on the left. And I think it's also affected the talk about the Middle East and about Israel. My biggest regret and kind of sadness is some of the things that I encounter on university campuses today. I don't see any opportunity almost at all of dialogue between myself as the Israeli representative and Palestinian American students or Muslim or Arab students on campus. Something which did happen in the past. There used to be debates. It didn't have to be, by the way, with the Israeli. It could be with an Israeli academic or someone representing the Israeli viewpoint. I see much less debate, much less willingness for dialogue. And now a kind of view by some of these young Palestinian Americans or similar type groups that the actual act of dialogue, the actual act of speech, of communication, is itself a concession which one should not be willing to give into. I also see a kind of delusional politics where they are talking about Israel not existing, and they talk about every aspect of international law which Israel violates, in their view, except for the international law which established Israel. And this I find depressing.
The United States' effort against the war on terrorism since 9/11, from Israel's perspective, has it been effective? Has it made Israel more or less secure? Do you see potential success there?
On this, I really do not think that Israel is the issue. The United States faced a threat from al-Qaeda and has dealt with it to, I think, the best of the United States' capacity and with a great commitment of resources. We have dealt with terrorism within our own region for a much longer period. And I think the two are not that related. The terror threat which the United States has faced and which the emergence of the al-Qaeda type ideology is a kind of ideology which doesn't really relate to Israel at all. It's anti-Western, it's anti-liberal, it's anti- any kind of political ideal which does not configure or even adopt a certain form of very fundamentalistic Islam. And as such, it threatens all freedom and all people. So the success of the West against that, which can be called the war on terror, can be called the war against the ideology of al-Qaeda, is also our success. But at a tactical level, we're dealing with our own issues. And we built a security barrier when we had no other way to stop suicide bombers from exploding in our cities every day. And that's the way we've had to deal with it.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point where we have time for just one more question, and we'll touch one more subject. And that is, what will the natural gas fines mean to Israel?
I can tell you what I hope it won't mean. up until now, so Israel has now discovered natural gas on the seafloor of the Mediterranean within our within economic zone for exploitation by Israel under international law. And up till now, we've been a country which pretty much has not had any natural resources. And I think it's the best thing that ever happened to us, because it's required us to form a knowledge-based economy, to focus on competitiveness, to educate our public, and to provide public education at a very high level, because otherwise we cannot compete economically or maintain our defense or succeed as a society. And I very much hope that the fact that we've struck oil, so to speak, will not change that. It is good to have some sort of fossil fuel resource. That is a nice thing. We have to make sure that it doesn't cause the shekel to appreciate. I really hope that it will not affect our very, very laser-like focus on clean technology or our attempt to put into place the world's first electric car economy in Israel. So I have to say that I have mixed feelings about it. It's good luck. I hope it will make our lives a little bit easier. I hope that my government will be wise enough to make sure that these revenues go for education and for infrastructure, and that we be very, very, that we don't act in a nouveau riche way.
We end on a positive note. Our thanks to Israeli Consul General Akiva Tor for his comments here tonight. We also want to thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 109 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.